want to turn it over to Dahlia in a minute. Dahlia is a fellow here at the Berkman Center. She is also a visiting scholar at the Center for Civic Media at MIT. She has a lot of things that she's working on right now. One of them that is taking up a good portion of her time is pouring through the Arab language blogosphere and looking at Twitter maps from various countries. So we're going to get an update of what's going on in social media over there. It's now 3 years since the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. In a couple hours, we'll have the official announcement of the next president of Egypt. And it's not a question of who it's going to be, but how many people are going to turn out and what the margin of his victory is. It's been, 4 years plus since the Iranian Green Revolution. Yeah. It's been almost a decade since the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, and they've been through many political lifetimes since then. We've gone kind of penduluming back and forth through enthusiasm and pessimism about the activities in the network public sphere of the impact of social media on social and political events. So this is a nice time to take a calm, measured look at what's going on there and revisit some of these ideas.
So I think many of you are familiar with this image, especially back in early 2011 when this took over our TV screens, our laptop screens, and sort of took over the news cycle. This is Tahrir Square. This is also maybe a familiar image of the Tunisian Revolution. So we initially started to see a lot of these images at first, and then we started seeing images like these. And this. And this. And I particularly like this one because in Arabic it says Nas book or people's, the people's book instead of Facebook. Again, disclaimer, did not start the revolution. I just want to take a step back and sort of talk about my history or my link to this. When the revolution started, I was actually in New York trying to write my master's thesis, probably failing to do so initially when the revolution started. And I remember spending hours and hours just glued to my laptop screen, looking at Twitter, looking at Facebook, and I had Al Jazeera English and Al Arabi and all these different broadcasts playing at the same time while Skyping with my parents who were back home in Ramallah talking about the situation. And it was just, I remember getting a lot of the news and a lot of the information from Twitter first or from my Facebook feed, because I also spent some time in Egypt and had a lot of friends who were in Tahrir Square. And a lot of that, I got that news first and then happened to see it in mainstream media, which was a fascinating thing to me at the time. And I'd like to think that I helped participated by, even though I was miles away, I participated with this by sending out information or retweeting things. So it was definitely my connection to the revolutions. I wish I could play this. Maybe I can. It's a video that probably a lot of you are familiar with. It actually shows, it's got beautiful visuals, but it shows the tweets and retweets right before Mubarak stepped down. Minutes before that, and how Twitter was sort of how people were tweeting, and then right after, and about an hour later, and it's fascinating how it ignites. I guess partially as a result of the revolutions, there's been a lot of literature that has come out. That's a few of them. Some of them happened to be right before the revolutions, or people were interested in what was going on in the Arab world beforehand, and then a lot of it ignited after that, looking at Twitter data, looking at sort of the blogs as well. And obviously, this is something that came out of here. This was a report that came out of the Berkman Center back in 2009, and it was, again, pre-revolutions, very interesting sort of study that came up with conclusions and results about the Arab blogosphere itself. And you know, some of the observations that came out back in 2009 were the fact that it's not pan-Arab. It's not one Arab entity, but rather there are different countries that are country-based focus clusters or blogs. The largest population on the, in the blogosphere was Egypt and Saudi Arabia, came in a second. Egypt was huge in terms of population-wise. Major topics were things like personal diaries were huge. People love to write about their lives online. It was a huge thing. And you'll see coming up in the new iteration of this how huge it is. It still is. Interestingly enough, and I think part of it is because the data was collected in 2008, 2009, a lot of focus was on Palestine, especially after the Gaza war that had happened. And so there was a lot of bloggers who were writing about that. And of course, religion was also another huge issue with some, in sense, some attention on minorities like Christian minorities and Baha'is. These are just some of the results, but I think the reason why I bring them up is because they're relevant to what we're going to be looking at in 2014. This is the new map. This is the map that we've actually, through the seed set that I talked about, we've managed to come up with. And again, like with the help of Morningside Analytics that have been able to come up with the sort of algorithms, the system itself that has pulled up all that links, all that network, and also the visuals, the amazing visuals that we see. So I'm going to take a step back and sort of talk about what we're actually, how we're, what lens we're taking or what we're looking at. We're taking this from the perspective of the network public sphere. And maybe I should have you explain it. And I guess, like Rob said earlier, we keep going back and forth and trying to determine what is the network public sphere when it comes to the Arab world. And the reason why I have this this image, it's actually of the SOPA PIPA debate that the Berkman Center also released a report about. And what's interesting about this is that early on in the debate, and I'm not going to go through details about SOPA PIPA, I'm assuming everyone knows that, but early on in the debate, there were a lot of tech blogs that were talking about this, and they sort of maintained and carried that conversation forward until we had that famous blackout, online blackout that we witnessed and that resulted in sort of shelving SOAP and PIPA, at least for now. And so it's interesting to see what happened in this case in, with SOAP and PIPA and how the Arab blogosphere would play into that. What are people sort of, what are the political and social issues that Arabs are keen about and concerned with and are blogging about? I can switch, maybe. Okay. So, and how we're actually going to do this. We're taking it from a social network analysis approach. So we're actually looking at this, looking at the networks that are linked together in terms of blogs and the Twitter sphere. Sorry, I'm trying to pull up. So, and the reason why social network analysis is really key is that it'll give us an idea of what key countries, who are the prominent countries that are blogging or tweeting, who are the key factors or key players in this, what are the topics that they're talking about. Again, it's sort of gives us this whole understanding or better understanding of what is the network public sphere in the Arab world. So I've managed to label some or part sections of the map itself. The nodes that use, you know, the methodology we're using to actually create this map is that the nodes themselves are actual individual blogs. The size of it is based on how many people are linking to it. So the larger it is, the more links. And also the colors themselves are actually clusters where blogs are linking to, sort of to the same thing. In some sense, it means that they're interested or they're talking about the same thing because they tend to link to the same sources. So you see clusters that are the same color. And they're sort of spread out or across the map using basic physics algorithm, where it's like the more people are related or the more blogs that are related to each other, the closer they are, the less they're related, the farther they are in the map. And you'll see that there's a big chunk right on the right, and that's Egypt right there, which also happens to be the largest the largest population again. And you see some other clusters here and there, Kuwait, Syria, Palestine. And I've, like, in the case of Egypt, there are so many different topics that they're talking about that I had to label them differently with, like, Egypt's left, secular, and I'll talk more about that, and the Muslim Brotherhood, personal diaries, again, that have shown up. January 2014, I want to say. I think that was
over many months.
But it was up to January 2014. Again, based on seed sets that we had provided. So, again, what we find out this time around, the map definitely does not represent this, and that's sort of the Arab world that we're talking about. It's more like this, where it's not one Arab world. It's actually clusters and different countries that are talking to each other. And most of it, predominantly, I want to say almost three quarters of it, is actually country-based, where you see clusters just mostly focusing on their own local news or clusters. Again, Egypt is the largest node. And I think I'd like to say that part of it is because Egypt has the largest population. I think that was what was said as well in the 2009 report. It was assumed that because they have the largest population, that they tend to have the largest population online. Attention? Well, Palestine is not so important anymore. And that's something that has, I think, come up as a result of the Arab revolutions. In a sense, a lot more countries, especially like Egypt or Tunisia, are focused on their local news, and Syria, obviously, on their local news more so than Palestine. And it would be interesting to see what happens in the near future as maybe news dies down about certain countries, and whether Palestine will sort of, if anything happens, any violence ignites in that region, in Palestine itself, Palestine, Israel, if that attention refocuses or not. Something that I will definitely be talking about later on is a noticeable blogging fatigue, or what Helmi has actually dubbed blogging fatigue. Something that we have definitely noticed is that there's a lot of inactivity that has that is in the current map that did not exist in 2009. And there are some blogs that have stopped, bloggers basically have stopped writing. It starts off with 2009, but really sort of becomes more and more of an issue in 2011 onwards, especially in 2013. And they're mostly around political bloggers. So the political bloggers are no longer blogging, and yet somehow they appear on our map because they tend to not write about issues, but sort of add banners and images of what their ideological or political preference is. And so you see banners, especially after what happened over the summer, of people supporting the Muslim Brotherhood with the famous sign, the Rabah sign, which is the four fingers with a yellow background. So you see those on banners, but you don't see people blogging. And the other interesting question is, Saudi Arabia is almost non-existent in this map. And looking at Twitter numbers and how Twitter has emerged, sort of become more and more popular throughout the Arab world, Saudi Arabia has the highest population of people on Twitter. And so it's interesting to see whether, or to study this, to see whether people stopped blogging and shifted to Twitter. Also sort of connects with the possible blogging fatigue that we're witnessing. With Egypt, like I said, and mentioned on the map, there are a lot more, there are a lot of different topics that are being covered there. And what's interesting is that whereas Saudi Arabia was the second largest cluster in 2009, Kuwait is the second largest cluster in this map. And there's a very interesting thing, we were talking about this earlier, it's like there are different, it's like almost a language and topic divide in Kuwait. Whereas you have the Arabic-focused or language blogs that are blogging about politics and local sort of political legislation in Parliament, whereas the English is more focused on social issues like expo events or let's rate the latest restaurant. And so it's interesting how the language divide comes across in terms of the Kuwait blogosphere. And a lot of them are hosted as well. Like the English-speaking blogs are not on blogging platforms, but rather hosted sites, which is a curious thing. With Palestine, there's also an interesting thing in regarding the language as well, whereas in for the English, there are two clusters for Palestine that are specifically Palestine-based. And for the English, it's more focused on talking about the occupation and how to end the occupation. And they act as if they're what Ethan Zuckerman has coined as bridge figures, where they're trying to bridge the situation on the ground with the Western audience. Whereas the Arabic is, the Arabic cluster, Arabic language is focused on talking about life under occupation. And that, I think, is more facing towards the Arab world. So that's just interesting divides within the language. I want to take a minute and talk about Egypt, especially the political clusters in Egypt. And what we tend to see, at least in terms of media, is that there's a pro-Morsi or pro-Muslim Brotherhood camp and then an anti-pro-military camp. And in reality, you know, it's almost like a division between both camps. And in reality, that's not the case. And we see that in both the blogosphere and the Twitter maps, which I'll talk about in a second. And what's interesting is that there is a Muslim Brotherhood cluster, and that's, you can see a unified cluster, whereas on the other hand, on the other side, it's the what we'd like to call left secular liberal politics, or maybe anti-Muslim Brotherhood. Some are anti-Muslim Brotherhood, anti-military, some are purely anti-Muslim Brotherhood, and there isn't this unified cluster or set of clusters. So it seems like politically they seem to be scattered and all over the place. And so,
explain SCAF for those who don't know.
Oh, SCAF is the military. It's the something security something. It's basically the military. And so it's not that, but rather that. And all over the place, and especially amongst left-wing or leftist bloggers, where you don't see one unified entity as opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood. One other interesting thing that has popped up, yes, I see people laughing or recognizing this. Even though, you know, we may recognize this, or the Syrian Electronic Army, or have heard of hacking incidents, what's interesting enough on the map is that the pro-Assad bloggers are non-existent. We have the Syrian clusters are focused mostly on pro-revolution issues and human rights issue. So we don't see any pro-Assad bloggers whatsoever on this map, which is something quite interesting, even though they have quite a sort of presence, at least online, in terms of hacking. So that's another interesting observation, and I'm curious as to why that is the case. Topics, again, personal diaries, romance, huge, probably the largest issues that Arabs tend to blog about. I can't tell you how many hours I spent looking at romantic relationship blogs with, like, hearts coming down the screen. And, yeah, it was at some points quite painful and quite pink and red. Like I said, with the politics, it's the division is not as clear as we'd like to think it is, at least in Egypt. Palestine, you know, again, Palestine is sort of referenced, but it's mostly focused on the Arab revolutions, not surprisingly. One very interesting thing that I guess I can link to politics and activism is this education cluster. What emerged from Egypt is a set of teachers have taken it upon themselves to write about education in Egypt. And so you see different districts, different schools, and teachers actually writing about the situation. What the Ministry of Education talked about or did, what the government is doing, and what the situation is for education. And that's very interesting because that definitely did not exist prior to the revolution, at least. Religion and minorities, again, religion not surprisingly, is a big issue. It's mostly focused on a certain, sect of Islam, which is Sunni Muslims. There are a lot of people who choose to write about their faith, but there is also a cluster where you have religious scholars that teach and preach about the faith itself. And interestingly enough, because that's a topic-based cluster, they come predominantly from Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And so it's mostly scholars from those both countries and Sunni that actually sort of write and write about or preach about Islam. Baha'is have a cluster, and historically, if anyone knows anything about Egypt, it's historically Baha'is have not had many rights in Egypt. In fact, they were oppressed, and they can't even declare their identity or religious identity, and they've taken that online. So that's another interesting thing. And literature, finally, with literature, there are a lot of people who are published authors and who prefer to express themselves through short stories that have actually started up like clusters of blogs, and they'd link to each other's stories. And so that was something that I guess is separate from personal diaries, but interesting nonetheless. Language divide. Like I said, it's a lot of the blogs are actually in Arabic. Some are in English, and they're, of course, because of the Maghreb or Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco, bloggers tend to choose to blog in both French and Arabic. Whereas in English, like in the case of Kuwait and Palestine, some of the blogs are more bridge figure-like or Western-facing and tend to be political. Some of them are tech blogs where people write in English but on tech-specific issues. And there was quite an interesting expat community. There was an Iraqi cluster that basically were mostly people living abroad and writing about Iraq. And so they would obviously write in English. Just a really quick observation. The majority of the bloggers use Blogger as a platform, Google, Blogspot. And that was very interesting. I don't know whether it's because it's sort of more user-friendly to use, or this is what people were introduced to early on and just continue to use that. And it's just amazing why they just, a lot of them, I would say almost 80 to 90% of them are on Blogger, use Blogger. There are some WordPress, but again, a small minority. Like in the case where I said in Kuwait, they actually just, the bloggers decide to host their sites. And that's an interesting thing, maybe an indication that they actually do, they have some wealth or are able to pay money to host their sites, or maybe it gives some validation to what they're writing. And then there were a few cluster of focusing on Tumblr sites. Twitter. So another part of this project is focusing not just on the Arab blogosphere, but also on Twitter maps. Like I said, we're doing Egypt, Bahrain, and Tunisia initially. And this is just sort of a map of the Arab world, Twitter usage in the Arab world. And as you can see, Saudi Arabia is a large chunk. I think from the numbers, I think the latest numbers that I have are go back to March 2013, and there are almost 4 million Arabs on Twitter. That's an okay number, I would guess, I'd say. And with Saudi Arabia being almost half of that overall. And these are the Twitter maps. Again, just a reminder, these are very, very early results of what we're seeing on the maps, and of course I'd appreciate any feedback that you have. I'm just going to show you sort of Bahrain and Egypt initially. And it's a rather interesting observation, because if you see, Bahrain is almost split in half. There's like a division where you see a large cluster here and a large cluster there. And almost somewhat the same with Egypt, where there is some like division. What's interesting though is with Bahrain, it's a political division, as opposed to Egypt, where it's divided based on social and political lines. With Bahrain, you see mostly the pro-government people on Twitter following each other, and then you see the pro-revolution people. And there are a lot of Western journalists that tend to follow this cluster and human rights activists that tend to follow this cluster. And Shiites from, you know, from the Shiite sect from across the region that span. And you see a lot of, obviously, interestingly, actually, military figures on Twitter here, and followed by the military, and also a lot of following from the Gulf, from Gulf countries, from Saudi Arabia, from the UAE, from Kuwait. So this is a very interesting divide. Egypt, on the other hand, you've got the politics on this side and social cultural issues on that side. And it's all based on followers, who's following who. What's interesting is that, again, it's very diluted, or there isn't one clear division in politics. You see a pro-military cluster here, an anti-military, anti-Muslim Brotherhood cluster here, and pro-Muslim Brotherhood clusters. But they tend to intertwine quite a bit, and we can't get a clear distinction. Sometimes you see someone who's anti-military and anti-Muslim Brotherhood in the pro-military cluster, and it's very linked together. Again, not a unified one chunk, one block. So there are some observations that have come up while I've been doing this research. And one really important question that has come up is, who's actually using social media in the Arab world? Who are these people that are on Twitter, who are blogging, or maybe not so much anymore, but you know, and are on Facebook? And I'd like to say that it's mostly predominantly because the digital divide, in some sense, is still it still exists in the Arab world. We may be looking at the middle class and also the elite in these societies. And that's just something worth looking at, and how that actually affects what is being written, and also how that plays out in sort of on the ground as well, what's happening on the ground. Another interesting thing that I have observed, I guess, prior my time to Berkman, but I've tried to actually follow through looking at the network analysis, I've been involved with a number of activists, Palestinian and Egyptian activists, and what's interesting is that these communication channels exist between a certain number of activists, and that is obvious in some of the Twitter maps where you see some Bahrainis who are followed by Palestinians and by Egyptians. So there are some communication, even though we might not see them or they're not obvious, they exist amongst these activists, and they tend to exchange information and tactics. And finally, burnout amongst political bloggers. I had to put in a cat picture, even though it is actually quite a serious issue. And there's, as I said, in the Arab blogosphere, we've seen signs of burnout. People are no longer actively blogging. And there are a lot of questions as to where they are now. Have they switched to other platforms? Have they gone to Twitter and Facebook and realized that, you know, it's faster for them to relay information? Or have they given up altogether? This is something worth looking into and seeing where, you know, possibly questioning some activists, asking activists to see what's happened to that. And whether it's a burnout as a result of the political situation. I mean, we've got the Egyptian elections, and we kind of already knew who the president is. This is a hypothesis that might seem common sense, I guess. And the question, this hypothesis is, are the governments catching up? Not too long ago, Turkey censored or banned Twitter. But I think even though censorship still exists, like we see in the case of Turkey, we're seeing a lot more government or pro-government people joining these platforms and trying to dilute those messages. And so we see in some cases the pro-military in Egypt, we see them trying to actually join in the message, use hashtags, use the platform to actually bring in the pro-military message in there. And so I think at some point we're going to see more and more of governments who are joining in those, whether it's their supporters or the governments themselves, like in Bahrain, where we see military personnel on Twitter, trying to join these platforms and actually try to dilute the message from the other for the other side. So that's just a hypothesis. It's worth looking into as well and see what comes up in future. The future. Are we going to see a shift to new platforms? Is Twitter and Facebook enough? Are people, is the burnout, you know, the cycles of burnout that we're seeing, is that going to result in an adoption of a new platform? Or is this more of we give up and we're not going to do this and a new generation will come and pick this up? These are all questions that are worth looking into. And you know, to look at new tactics, whether it's using hashtag trends for activists to actually push their information forward or looking at the communication channels that are happening between them. These are all things worth looking into and questions for the future, I guess. And one final note, almost done. I just want to say that even though we're doing this research here and we're looking at all these network maps, it is worth noting that there are these bloggers are out there on a daily basis risking themselves and risking their lives. And only in the past month, I've had some of them friends, activist bloggers who have been arrested by their respective governments. And it's worth just putting the message out there or just recognizing what they've been doing. Thank you.
So we will go ahead and open things up for questions. I want to take the moderator's prerogative and ask the first question, if you don't mind. So you've painted a picture of where there's a shift in platforms. A lot of people have moved from blogging into Twitter, and you didn't discuss Facebook, but there's a whole lot more going on there as well. And you've also described a shift kind of in attention and emphasis as well. So perhaps there's less focus on Palestine, more on domestic issues and those kinds of things. Between looking at Twitter and the blogosphere, you know the region very, very well. Is this a reasonable reflection of the social and political state of affairs in these places? Or to ask the question another way, are there parts of the picture that are missing in what you see in digital media?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think part of it, what we're seeing online, is a reflection of what's going on the ground in the sense where we don't see defined lines or defined divisions in politics. So it's as it is on the ground, I think, especially in Egypt, the left is not entirely unified. You've got a lot of divisions within the left, and yet with the Muslim Brotherhood, they're quite unified. So in some sense, yeah, there are reflections. And then going to Syria, on the other hand, the absence, the complete absence of pro-Assad bloggers is something to look into. It's worth looking into. It's like, do they not blog, or what is it that they're using to actually send out their message? Is it hacking? And so in some sense, yes, it is an interesting sort of portrayal of what's going on the ground, but at the same time, to a certain extent, the online world is not enough for us to see what's going on offline. I don't know if that answers your question. It's like yes and no in some sense.
Yeah. Fair enough. Let's go in, please.
This was very, very interesting. Thanks for the lecture.
Just speak up, please.
Very interesting. Thanks for the lecture. How big is Instagram in this scene? Because there's been reports floating around of Instagram being used by the less people that write less or less are less well versed in text using Instagram.
We don't have data for that, but that's quite an interesting observation. I think the question is, we'd look at sort of who's using Instagram and who can use it. So in a lot of countries, what is the rate of smartphones versus feature phones versus, you know, the lesser quality, and who can actually go online and post on Instagram. And so that would be something interesting to look into, not just the data, but who's actually using it. And whether it is a literacy issue or a technology issue or something else, or it's just a preference, like people prefer to use Snapchat. So I don't know if you had something.
I have no idea. Did you have any reason to believe that that's true?
I know that the Instagram is used for us as a marketplace for selling sheep.
Yeah.
Using hashtags.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
You mentioned that there was appeared to be blogging burnout, people stopping using their blogging platforms. To what extent did these people actually stop participating, or did they just move their activity over to Twitter or Facebook, where it's harder to find them?
That's the question.
But I think that's happening way outside the Arab world also. So
yeah, I think we've had that conversation as well, that we're seeing signs of that across in other countries as well. But that is a question where, you know, I think we'd like to investigate at some point. And it's, have they stopped blogging and stopped participating all in all, or switched to Twitter or Facebook, where it's no longer the commentary or writing pieces, writing your opinion is not as important, or Twitter and Facebook has eased that in a sense where you can write a 140 character and then send out your opinion and have a conversation that way instead of actually writing up a long blog post and expect people to comment. So I think it might be a shift. It might be complete burnout. I think it's worth looking into.
Social media that are only found in the Arab world and that we're not aware of because they're internal to that region.
How do you define, what do you mean by social media?
Like, for instance, you know, China has their own equivalents of Facebook and Twitter that are not used in the U.S. Are there similar things in any of the Arab countries that people may have shifted to?
So I think I want to say no, because according to Alexa and sort of rankings of sites throughout different countries in the Arab world, we see that Google and Facebook are the top two sites across the region. And so I think, no, it's still, like, Facebook is still a huge issue. Twitter less so, but most people are on Facebook. And, yeah, so I don't think there's an equivalent of that. No.
I just wanted to ask a question which is similar to what's been raised before, and that is really the question of relativity between the different groups that you've been looking at. You mentioned a couple of times population, you've mentioned digital divide, etc. Have you looked at taking all the data and adjusting it according to population, internet access, number of smartphones, all these things, to try and weight it so you can see, is this just pure gross numbers, or does it mean something more important? In the sense, you said, for example, Egypt, which has a big population, of course, is big on your map. But it would be interesting if, I don't know, Palestine was more important given a smaller population, for example. Have you done those assessments or adjustments, or is that too difficult?
You want to take this?
I'll field this one.
Okay.
So there's no simple math in that. So these maps are drawn by social networks based on inlinks, and there would be, I guess, a logic for the size of a network where there are 100 bloggers, 1,000 bloggers, but I'm not sure what that is. It's not merely counting the number of blogs, because this, none of these maps are inclusive of all the blogs. Mm-hmm. We chop off the long tail. And what this is the most prominent blogs and most prominent Twitter accounts users based upon the inlinks, or in the cases of Twitter, by followers coming in. So a great idea, and not so easy to implement. Yeah.
And I think, yeah. I mean, in the case of Palestine, there might be more bloggers because there's some reasoning, sort of a cause that would push people to actually go online and express that where they can't in other fields. So, yeah.
I mean, that said, there's not a simple map. If you look at population and participation, it's not there. Not there. There's countries missing from the mix that are interesting in the run.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting numbers that you came up with was the high rate of Twitter usage in Saudi Arabia, where there's almost no blogging. I'm wondering, does that correlate in some way with government censorship? And does that affect the relative use of these different media? Because with a relatively small population of Saudi Arabia, to have half the Twittering in the Arab world seems extremely high.
So I think, I mean, I can't speak for censorship in Saudi Arabia. I'm not the expert. But
it's interesting to see the rate of sort of smartphones, the increase in smartphones in Saudi Arabia, which seemed to be a huge thing, and 3G networks as well, where 3G came in early on, smartphones developed or increased early on. And so I think switching from using your laptop to using your phone for almost everything is what has maybe shifted the platform. And like I said, I think people have more of a conversation, maybe, on Twitter, more so than actually writing a long blog post and sort of waiting for comments or a conversation that way. And I think that's part of why we're seeing this shift, basically technology and why people tweet.
So you think there may be some correlation between relative use of Twitter versus blogging and relative use of smartphones versus laptops?
To a certain extent, I think. But not a complete one, yeah.
I'd happily follow up on the censorship angle. Yeah. So Saudi Arabia is an interesting example of a place that did not seriously invest in rolling out the internet until they could install first the means to filter the internet as well. So what that means is that all internet traffic into Saudi Arabia is run through a proxy farm there, which means they can do very fine-grained filtering of the internet. They can filter at the URL level. So they were indeed filtering individual blogs, not a lot of them, but enough of them, and people understood where the line is. They can also block individual Twitter handles, and they do that as well. So I'm more sold on the cultural explanation that Dahlia gives in the censorship and the technological than the censorship angle. It's an interesting question, though. For some reason, everyone has shifted.
On the question of burnout, are you seeing actual textual evidence on the blogs that the bloggers that have stopped blogging, sort of in their last posts, you know, fewer comments or them saying, like, I'm tired of talking about this? Or is it just you're seeing people stop blogging and you're hypothesizing?
Yeah, burnout? So in some cases, yes. I would say rare cases, they tend to say, this is my last blog, I'm done. In other cases, there's a shift, and I know some Egyptian bloggers who have shifted from blogging to and tweeting to completely just basically tweeting, and they've stopped blogging. So in some cases, it could be burnout where I'm not going to blog anymore and deem this sort of site inactive. In other cases, there's been a switch. And like I said, there's an interesting observation where, especially in Egypt, people may not be writing or actively writing on the blogs, but they change banners. And so they still maybe, I guess, have a connection to the blog and haven't completely detached themselves from them. But and they do that by declaring who they're supporting. And that's interesting. I mean, is that an indicator that there is burnout or people just don't want to blog, don't feel like there's any significance in blogging anymore? It's questions worth looking into, to be honest.
The other thing that you mentioned, which I found very interesting, was people who put up a blog post and then tweet it out, and there's fewer links. Like the connective tissue is in many cases Twitter now and not the blogosphere. Mm-hmm. When we did the original map in 2009, mm-hmm. the blogosphere was the only game in town, so that the network logic was all implicit in that map. And here it's there still, but it doesn't give you the entire picture. A lot of the connective tissue is often Twitter.
Yeah, I think Twitter and Facebook, to be honest. Like, a lot of people share things over, especially in the Arab world, they share things on Facebook. And so they might either share news or write up a blog post and share it. And so the conversation is definitely shifting. And when you have a conversation on Facebook and Twitter, what happens to the blogosphere then?
I'm really interested in the dilution aspect of this. You're theorizing that perhaps their government or military sources are going to try and dilute the activist messages online. Have you seen any evidence of that, or how would we watch for that? Do you think that they're trying to use? Because I'm thinking about the maps, right? And if you were somebody in the military who were looking at that map, trying to dilute it, would you use the same vocabulary and tweak it in certain ways? Or I didn't know if you had seen any examples.
So I guess that happens both on Twitter and Facebook as well. And it's having, first of all, the pro-government join the platform to begin with is one interesting sort of, that's one way to look at it. It's like, oh, you're seeing more and more, especially like with Bahrain, you have a whole section of the map that is pro-government. And yes, the people who believe in the same political ideology are going to follow each other. I think what would be interesting to look at is not just also how the pro-government supporters are joining, but also the use of tactics that other activists have been using in the past, whether it's hashtag trends. So joining in the conversation, there's one hashtag that is being used by say, pro-revolution activists, and having pro-government coming in and diluting those messages using the same hashtag. That is something to look out for. I know there's one incident that happened last summer in Ramallah. There were a group of activists who were demonstrating. I'm blanking out on what they were demonstrating. There are quite a few. They were demonstrating about something, and they were trying to get to the president's office, and they were stopped by the police. A shuffle happened. And you had some cops who were basically beating demonstrators and females, and you had video, like images of that, videos of that, and videos of people, the demonstrators using vulgarity against the police. And so you had both sides there. And both were videos were taken or shots were taken. What happened is that the, say, pro-government supporters went on Facebook and completely diluted the message. It was no longer about the demonstration. It was no longer about the fact that some of the police officers used brutality against the demonstrators. It ended up switching towards, oh, these people are using vulgarity and so on and so forth. And so that is something that's worth looking into. Again, we see that in Egypt as well, where you have a lot of people who are pro-military who are trying to push their discourse. I've been seeing a lot of images on my Facebook feed because of the elections that are happening, of like people posting pictures of them voting and like either carrying an image of Sisi, maybe future president of Egypt, or like, you know, doing some gesture that they're supportive of that. And that's actually filling up my feed. So that's another way to look at it. It's like where it's, you have a lot of people, pro-government actors who are adding to that sort of feed or the message. And so you can no longer distinguish in some sense, where you see a lot more of one thing than the other, and or using the same hashtags that activists are using. So it's like a number of things.
Just presence,
yeah.
And then hijacking of
pretty much the message. Yeah.
Thank you.
Can we just stay on this? I'm fascinated by government in social media and blogosphere. So, you point to in your conversation to two separate things. One is just governments who are there, and we see that we'll see that with Sisi's camp now in Egypt. You see it in the Bahrain Twitter sphere. We saw it in the Iranian blogosphere with the supporters for Ahmadinejad there. They were really people that really supported him. We've also seen examples of governments that are trying to get support going that weren't able to get any traction in that. We looked at Twitter and Russian blogs several years ago, and there was a lot of talk about the pro-Kremlin bloggers, people who are out there trying to seed the message and drum up support. They don't exist in the link economy. Like, nobody believes them. And I think there's you need to have people who I think are receptive to the message in order to pick up on that. And that's, for my taste, I think all the maps I've seen so far are reflective of real political support on the ground and where it doesn't exist. So, with the one asterisk being the Assad example, puzzles me a little bit.
Yeah, that's.
I know there is support for that, and for them to not exist there is a little bit puzzling in itself.
Yeah, it is puzzling. But I think, yes, it is sort of, especially with Egypt, there is a large number of the population that does support the military and the current government. And we see that as well in local media in Egypt, where it's like, pre-June 30th last year, it was business as usual. And then when the military took over, it was like almost like a switch in reporting. And that, and, you know, the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood are now considered a terrorist group and so on and so forth. And it was a switch. And there were a lot of people who switched with that. There were a lot of people who were disgruntled with the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, 30 yeah. million people out in the streets demonstrating against Morsi. So there was definitely that, where it's like, yes, there is active support. But what's interesting to see the percentage of representation.
Yeah.
And whether they're using tactics that other activists had previously used, like the hashtag, or just flooding social media with images or messages,
right.
and trying to sort of overcome the other side.
That's more of an annoyance than anything, right? Is that effective, those
in some
kind
well,
of sabotaging of conversations?
It depends on the situation. I think in some cases where it's unclear what's going on in the grounds and you're seeing two messages come out of the grounds, then it might be worth looking into like what is actually coming out of the ground. And so getting information is important. But in some cases, yeah, it is, and it can be an annoyance. It just, I guess, really depends on what we're trying to get, what information we're seeing from the ground that's coming out. And what we need to see. Yeah.
It's not the only source of spam in Twitter.
Yeah, no, there's
others, yeah. The last piece on that is that the 2009 map, looking at the Egyptian clusters there, the Mubarak regime had no friends in the blogosphere. And
surprise, surprise.
Were we smart enough then to look at the map, we could have foretold kind of the political future of Egypt and the clusters that were there, and the strength and the cohesiveness of them mirror exactly to the political situation that currently exists in Egypt.
Yeah, which is interesting. Right now, we see a unified Muslim Brotherhood, which honestly isn't very surprising. But what's the interesting aspect of it is that the left is not so unified, and there's so many different political understandings and divisions and ideologies. So,
which again is consistent with...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It is consistent. And it's interesting to see what happens in the coming year or so with the current elections and what happens on the grounds if people tend to unify around a cause or not, and if that shifts online or vice versa. We'll see. Yeah.
How about applying the same analysis to Syria? Why do you think there was no real blogging in support of Assad, and is that indicative of the same problems that Mubarak had?
I would say the possibility of not seeing pro-Assad clusters is because, they don't have friends. And so it's even though in some cases there are some Arab countries that have, or groups,